Ready?
House Interim Committee on Revenue will come to order. I will note that we have two members on the phone, Representative Nose, Representative Whitsitt, who will interrupt us when they have questions.
The Senate Interim Committee on Finance and Revenue will come to order. Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the release of the December Economic Revenue Forecast. Let's get started and bring up our two economic forecasters. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you, Chair Haas, members of the committee. My name is Mark McMullen. I'm the state economist with the Oregon Office of Economic Analysis, joined, as always, by my colleague, Josh Lehner, to deliver the quarterly economic and revenue outlook. So the upshot this quarter is that the revenue outlook is still very stable at this time. What that means, unfortunately, is that growth is slowing, that the slowdown is upon us that we started to see in the U.S. data last time we met, and now it's starting to be reflected in Oregon data as well. Oregon's still growing faster than the typical state, even though we've come down a notch in terms of our growth, but nevertheless, it does appear to be palpable now. Now, that's not necessarily a bad thing insofar as the growth that we've been seeing is really unsustainable over the long term. It was fine as we're digging ourselves out of the hole of the recession, but now that the labor market is closer to healed, we can't support those kind of growth rates forever. And so we had built the slowdown into our baseline outlook. And so although now that's coming to pass, the revenue outlook is very stable and unchanged because to date, at least, this slowdown has matched what was expected when the budgets were crafted. So at the U.S. level, we're starting to think about recession. Now, a slowdown at the U.S. level, they're not seeing a slowdown. In fact, we're starting to see improvement across the board. We're seeing improved employment growth, improved output growth. The inventory overhangs have started to clear up at the U.S. level. And so at the U.S. level, the recovery or expansion really does seem to be still on quite a bit of solid footing. Just because we're seeing a slowdown, it doesn't necessarily mean there's a higher probability of a recession. A slowdown or a recession are really fundamentally different things. In a recession, you're actually switching the car into reverse actively, rather than just slowing down how fast you're going forward. It's a different behavioral issue. And so last time we were here, there was a little bit of heightened concern that maybe we were had a recession on the way, or at least in the next year or two. But some of those concerns are starting to lighten up a little bit. In particular, it looks like the manufacturing slowdown might not be as drastic as previous cycles. And in fact, the weakness we saw in non-energy manufacturing and in trade last time is starting to improve a little bit. And so along with that, U.S. forecasters have nudge down their likelihood of a recession coming in the very near term. But there is quite a bit of uncertainty out there, and what economists are certainly talking about now more than anything else is federal policy, the outlook for federal policy going forward. And this is quite a bit of a wild card with us, with the new president-elect. It's really unclear what policies will be enacted. But certainly, I guess the consensus out there is some of the policies that were talked about on the campaign trail would be to the detriment of growth, but we're going to have to see which ones of those are actually manifest themselves. And from our process, we're going to keep this sort of thing at arm's length and take it from our consulting firm that we use for our U.S. forecast. We're going to go ahead and take the outlook for federal policy from them and see how that feeds through in future rounds. But as I said, the U.S. economy in general is doing better and looking like things are, it's still moving in the right direction. Whereas in Oregon now, we're finally starting to see a slowdown manifest in our numbers, although again, we're still doing better than the typical state.
Chair Haas, members of the committee. For the record, Josh Lehner, Office of Economic Analysis. And what you see here is sort of the average monthly job gain in the state of Oregon by quarter in recent years. And you can see the nice acceleration we've seen coming off the depths of the Great Recession all the way up to 5,000 jobs a month in recent years. Last couple of years, we've added 5,000 jobs a month. As Mark said, that's unsustainable. Those are peak growth rates coming off of a recession, and those are unsustainable over the long haul because we only need something around 2,000 jobs a month to keep up with population growth. And so 5,000 eats up the economic slack, gets you to a much better spot in the economy, but it's not sustainable. And so what we're seeing is we're starting to see the slowdown hit the forecast, hit the actual data. And what this graph tries to do, and probably not the most clear way, is show that we just got some revisions in the data yesterday. We've been building these into our forecast a little bit in recent months. Two quarters ago, back in the second quarter of the year, April, May, and June, Oregon saw on a month-over-month hardly any job growth at all. They had been saying we're growing at 5,000 jobs a month, the full throttle. The employment data was showing all rosy signs. Well, that turned out not to be the case. We actually added significantly fewer jobs than that in the revised data. And then in the data most recently, the yellow bar, the preliminary data, also shows that we're at this step down. So we're now more like 3,000 jobs a month instead of 5,000 jobs a month. That's okay. It's still solid growth, still good growth. We're talking 2.5% job growth on a year-over-year basis instead of 3 to 3.5%. And this is in line with the general flavor of our economic forecast. The reason for this is some technical issues when it comes to the monthly survey of employers, and they estimate the jobs across the state. But at the same time, it also represents some losses in manufacturing. For the last year or so, we've been talking about how we're expecting a manufacturing slowdown. We're seeing at the U.S. level, it's going to hit Oregon, but we never really put in a lot of job losses. We just kind of said manufacturing is going to plateau. Well, now we're starting to see some manufacturing job losses, and durable goods in particular. We had the cuts at Intel. Of course, for computer and electronic product manufacturing, but other things, metals and machinery, aerospace has slowed down a little bit, and those have fed through, and we've lost some jobs in durable goods manufacturing. Even though our food processing here in the valley and whatnot is still doing well, the durable goods have seen losses, which is in line with what we're seeing at the national level. We're expecting a few more of those to continue in the coming quarters, just not a full-blown manufacturing cycle. As Mark was talking about earlier, a lot of those leading indicators are starting to turn up again, and we're kind of muddling our way through the weakness in manufacturing, but again, just showing up just now in the Oregon employment data. But again, so we've seen a step down in growth, and it's not just on the job side. Again, this comes from samples, and they try and blow it up to look at the whole population and what have you, but we're seeing it in our actual daily collections from the Department of Revenue.
That's right. This graph shows withholding out of folks' paycheck, basically the amount of personal income tax we take out of regular pay and bonuses and the like. And as you see here, we have hit a soft patch just about the same time as the employment numbers weakened in the spring and early summer months. And so now we're growing. It's still healthy rates. It's 4%, 5%, 6% growth rate is not bad, but nevertheless, it's resting near the bottom of the range we've seen over the last 3 or 4 years in terms of personal income tax growth. And so this is along the lines of what we had built into the model. Now, obviously, this is a very noisy series, and this could just be temporary weakness, as we've seen, several times in the past couple of years. But nevertheless, when we started to see the employment numbers and the job numbers weaken, and it's supported by this withholding, I think it does lend more support to this baseline outlook that we have, that as we've come to a more mature point in the business cycle, we're starting to wind down a little bit on our growth rates. And hopefully we can do this in a nice, orderly fashion. Typically, Oregon in its history hasn't transitioned to sustainable growth rates in an orderly fashion. It's been more like run hot for a couple years and then the bottom drops out. But nevertheless, this would be consistent in a lot of cases with that in terms of our outlook for the next biennium and whatnot. And nowadays, Oregon's different than it used to be as well. We have less exposure to manufacturing and natural resources than we did in terms of a share of our economy. And we're also a lot older than we were in terms of our workforce dynamics. And so the a slowdown that we've seen in some other industrialized countries, rather than a boom bust, may well be more plausible this time than in the past. But in terms of the boom bust, the most encouraging thing is that Oregon exports have started to turn around a little bit. They're still below where they were, certainly, and it's just this improvement is small, but it's relatively broad-based and encouraging insofar as it comes at the same time that the value of the dollar seems to have topped out, and some of our trading partners are starting to see a little bit of improved growth.
Right, and this is just an update on a graph we brought to you within the last year. And as Mark said, with the dollar, as soon as the price of oil and the oil crash hit a couple years ago, the dollar shot up 20 to 30% for the U.S. If you look at the Oregon dollar, if you reweight it based on our currency, our currencies with our trading partners on the Pacific Rim, it's more like a 30 to 40% jump in the Oregon dollar for our exporters, where our markets are. As soon as that did, we saw exports plunge, or at least non-tex exports to plunge by recessionary levels. And we brought this to you and said we're really worried about this. Well, here we go. In the last 6 months, certainly so far in 2016, non-tex exports have shot right back up, and they're growing at pretty substantial rates. And so this is an encouraging sign that maybe it was some sort of a temporary adjustment in the dollar, a temporary adjustment in exports in the manufacturing cycle, and we might be able to muddle through this. It doesn't mean the wheels are about to come off like it has generally historically been the case. And this improvement that we're seeing is across pretty much all of our main exporting sectors. Here's just a decomposition of some of these gains. The blue bars show what was the growth rate a year ago, and then the red bars are what is the growth rate today. And you can see the red bars are in a better position than the blue bars for pretty much everything. Even for wood products and forestry, they're still declining on a year-over-year basis, but at a slower rate than before. A lot of that's the weakening global demand for log exports and things like that. But tech's doing better. Agriculture has rebounded significantly. Heavy manufacturing is both a good news and sort of a mixed news story. There's an increase. We do a lot of automobile car exporting out of the Port of Portland. We don't make those cars here, of course, but they're exported via Portland, and they do some refinery work here. It seems like a lot of that's being coded to Portland and to Oregon more broadly as exports, even though they're not made here. They're made in Detroit or Tennessee or what have you. So they're not necessarily our exports per se, but that said, in the heavy manufacturing, machinery overall is continuing to do well. The weakness is showing up in the metals, and we've seen that in the metals employment and what have you. So the heavy manufacturing is rebounding for some good news, and then some probably miscoded data reasons. And that said, everything else beyond that, which is only 10 to 15% of our exports, are also up as well.
So we've prepared a couple quick topics before we tear into the revenues themselves, and the first being in response to a question from Chair Barnhart at our last meeting. At that time, the U.S. had just put out new numbers in terms of income growth across different across the distribution of household income levels, and a couple days later, we got the Oregon numbers, and that's what this chart that Josh put together looks into.
Right. So this chart here shows household income in Oregon adjusted for inflation over basically the last decade or since prior to the Great Recession for a couple different points in the distribution. They're organized by quintiles, so 20% chunks. The top 20% of households, the middle 20% of households, and then the bottom 20% of households. And you can see the income trends over the Great Recession and so far in recovery are quite evident. And again, this takes into account inflation, so nominally we're seeing stronger growth in this, but there's a couple good points here and a couple important reasons for why we're seeing this. A 2015 growth in household income, both at the national level and here in Oregon, saw its largest increase in more than a decade. So we're finally getting to the point where we're seeing some improvements in these broader measures of economic recovery. We've been talking about jobs and average wages for a long time with you guys, but it's just now bleeding through. We're finally hitting through to the typical household in the state. And the reason for that is the households in the middle and bottom part of the income distribution, the only sources of income they have basically are wages. and then the safety net programs, food stamps and Section 8 vouchers and things like that. So you have to get to the point where more Oregonians have jobs, and then the wages for the typical worker in the typical industry are starting to rise to finally lift household incomes in the middle and bottom part of the distribution. And we're at that stage now. And in fact, since 2012, the lowest 20% of Oregon households have seen the largest income gains in percentage terms over the most recent few years. Now, of course, they've experienced the worst trends, not only in the past decade, but in recent decades. And so this movement is around a long-term stagnant trend. We're having no growth in household income for a couple decades now. There's no question about that. But again, we're starting to see some of these positive signs where the stronger economy is finally reaching to the point where we're seeing gains. And of course, the higher income households have done better. They have a wider variety of income sources, capital gains, dividends, rental income, things like that that have generally outperformed in recent decades. So it's no surprise, given a lot of the discussion nationally about income inequality and things like that, that the higher income households have better economic trends. But again, we're finally getting to the point where we're seeing some good news on these fronts, like median household income, poverty rates are starting to fall, and things like that. We're just not fully healed there yet, but it's coming, provided the expansion continues.
That's right, with these delayed impacts, and in part the one. Oh, sorry.
Thank you. Just a quick clarification on that. So, am I reading that right? In that, since 2007, when you adjust for inflation, only the top quintile has household incomes have increased. The bottom is still 6.5% down from where they were inflation adjusted in 2007, and the middle is just under where they were.
That is correct. The second quintile and the fourth quintile kind of fill in these gaps here. That's kind of a nice stair step in there. I just removed them for simplicity's sake. So the top two quintiles have fully recovered, but the median household income, the middle 20%, are a percent below, and the lowest incomes are still 6-7% below.
Thank you.
That's right. Despite the recent growth, lower income households took such a big hit during the recession here. You see that they haven't made it all the way back up. But this is, like Josh says, we're starting to see it into these deeper measures of poverty and things that are always the last to turn around. And one of the last things to turn around are caseloads for our need-based programs. And so hopefully we'll start to see some relief going forward in terms of some of those. Perhaps the most encouraging thing we've seen in recent months is the population data and the population outlook. Again, Oregon is drawing folks in droves, as it typically does when jobs are available. We've shown this to you before, but the dark section is the net migration in terms of the folks that we pull in from other states and countries in Oregon, and then the light blue is the natural increase, which would be births minus deaths, which as we go out and the baby boomers pass away, you see that those are smaller than they have been in the past in terms of the forecast. But you see here what jumps out at you is most recent data, a 2016 estimate, is higher in terms of migration, net migration, than we've seen even during the tech boom. Now, that's not higher as a share of our population because we're much smaller back then, but nevertheless, in raw numbers, it's there. The Portland State University just published yesterday their 2016 mid-year population estimates, and they revised it up by about 4,000 more folks in Oregon. This is in keeping pretty closely with what our demographer had in terms of built into our model expectations in it to date. But this is encouraging. Now, obviously, this is at risk, and this is when last time we spoke to you, we did a housing meeting, and we talked a lot about the threat that housing affordability poses for our traditional advantage here. But right now, by all accounts, in terms of driver's licenses turned in or van line data or school enrollments, the population trends are back. One note about population growth and trends. I'm sorry.
Excuse me. Question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So can we tell the nature of the folks that are immigrating? I know in my part of the world, the mass migration from Idaho into Oregon was driven by the new marijuana law, so I don't want to draw conclusions about the nature of the folks that are so attracted, but perhaps you can share with us who's coming to Oregon.
Yes, Representative Bentz, Chair Haas. That's news to me, the marijuana migration, but we'll have to look deeper into that in the future. But the traditional migrants have been young folks, and traditionally young folks move for jobs or employment opportunities. So that's still true today. And it, although the data is a little bit lagged, it certainly appears that the pattern of those folks moving into Oregon is the same as it was. And insofar as we get a lot of folks from California, to a lesser extent in the Northeast, and we basically net positive from every state except for Idaho some years and some years not, and Washington. So we take a flow up from the South, and then we send some folks up north to Washington, and we, so we net lose from there. So typically that is still the majority of migrants, but we also get a wave of retirees and baby boomer folks, but these are not in every region of the state. They're typically at the southern coast, central Oregon, and the metropolitan areas.
Follow up. Thank you. But the nature of the folks that are coming here, where do we look to find out the type of folks that we added? I'd like to hear that we added middle income generating people that are coming here because of the really great job market and are instantly adding to the income necessary to pay for all of our programs. But perhaps that's not right. How would we find out?
What the IRS does data where they take a person's tax return that files in one state one year and files in the next state the next year. And so this is our best data in terms of tying the income trends with the migration. Unfortunately, it's a little bit lagged. Yeah. That there are two things going on. Oregon does tend to get some higher income migrants moving here, but on average, the migrant has a lower income than average because they're younger and they're mobile. And so, as with most states, that's the case here as well, that when you look at that gap.
Follow up again. And again, I'm just, when will we get our hands on this information, because it's of great interest to me.
And we also have, Josh was mentioning, we also have some ACS census data that does also show income levels as well, but it's harder to match the individuals with that as they do.
As a follow-up there, we have complete detailed migration data through 2014 via the census data. The 2015 data has just been released between the time 2 months ago when we met and today, and the detailed underlying census record data is available somewhat right now, but not necessarily in the most user-friendly format. So that's something we're working on, updating 2015 records. In terms of some of the stuff we've brought to you guys before, the young migrants, the majority of the young migrants moving to Oregon do have college degrees, and then within that you can decompose them, and the majority of those with college degrees do have technical, professional, and medical degrees. They're not just basket weavers and the like.
We hope. Thank you.
But from all accounts, it does appear that this population gains have increased. Now, one note associated with this is maybe not urgent this biennium, but certainly the next one is the next census. Josh mentions this, the ACS data, but they do the decennial census once every 10 years, which is a big deal in terms of the revenue side, in terms of funding. In the last couple of rounds, the 2000 census and the 2010 census, Oregon has underperformed the typical state in terms of digging up its respondents, finding its population. And this results in a significant loss of federal funds. And other states play the game harder than we do in terms of supporting the census and trying to help find some of these hard to count populations. And so, work to that end could be useful on the revenue side. So the upshot in terms of the outlook is roughly the same. As you see here, this is employment growth, and the slowdown we do see is upon us. The current forecast is a little bit slower, one, because of the revisions that Josh talked about to the jobs data, and two, because now we're starting to incorporate a few manufacturing job losses rather than just a plateau in the industry. But as you see, from there on in, the outlook is relatively similar as we transition down to these longer-term sustainable growth rates. So what does that mean for the revenue outlook and the revenue update? Well, so far, in terms of tracking, the revenues are keeping a pretty close pace with what was expected. And we got a few more. In terms of the personal income tax, our big-ticket item, We did see collections a little bit stronger than we expected during the fall season. The fall season is important because that is when we start seeing extension filers. And these include some of our wealthiest and highest income individuals with very complicated returns. They go ahead and pay an estimated payment on April 15th, but then don't have to file until the fall. And so sometimes this can move the needle, even though it's a small number of filers, you know, 4% of full year files or something like that. They're a good 15% of the refunds we kick out and the payments that we get along with returns. And so they sometimes do follow different trends. And as we say from our preliminary numbers, October's hard to tell because we changed the Department of Revenue processing system, so the banking numbers are, we don't have really a good year-over-year comparison right now. But it looks like the revenues have started to stabilize after we went ahead and released the kicker as part of the standard filing process this time. And so the kicker is now, the very vast majority of it is all behind us and out the door now, and it appears that we're back up to some modest growth rates, which is what we've built in. Very much like the employment outlook, we don't expect the sort of stuff that we saw there in 2015 to continue, but nevertheless do have growth built into the outlook. So with these extension filers, we saw a little bit more payments than we expected, and there was one difference that really did stand out, and that was in investment income. Here we're looking at capital gains, and I said, well, the extension filers are very important for overall collections. Well, they're even more important for capital gains and business income and the like. And here we see that these late filers did turn in quite a bit of realized capital gains. In terms of all the capital gains processed prior to September, about two-thirds of what we've seen this year. Last year and this year were virtually the same, unchanged in terms of the amount reported on tax returns. But then as we got into the fall and we started to see some of these high-end complicated returns, that changed. And we see we have some $500 million more in capital gains than we did last year among this subset of filers. So that's encouraging. Now, capital gains and income and revenues aren't necessarily tied together because, again, these folks did make an estimated payment in April. And so it's how that matches what they end up filing for later is really what matters, and as such, it looks like it came in a little higher than we thought. But it does fit the narrative of our forecast because part of what we had built into our capital gains and our revenue this round were one-time events in terms of we saw the sales of some of our large local companies, Precision Cast Parts and the Standard and the like, and we also had large charitable donations made to OHSU, where some of the donors would have to cash in some of their assets in order to make those donations. And so this would be consistent with that, this extra $500 million in late last-minute capital gains. Our concern right now is with corporate income taxes. Corporate excise taxes have been falling sharply. They're down about over the last 12 months, they're down about 17% relative to year ago, which is okay so far for the forecast because we had this correction built in up until about now. In the forecast right now, we have an 18% drop. So basically, since this is smooth four quarters, it still goes down for a little while later, for another couple of you know quarters here in terms of the chart. But the upshot is, it's about time that these things stabilize, or we're going to have to start reducing our forecast. We've taken off about what we expect to here, as you see, and so it's the numbers will have to start improving in the near term, or we're going to have to start shaving the outlook. So far the decline has really matched what we had built in. It's just crossing our fingers and hoping that it does going forward, and that the declines don't become more significant. So in terms of the overall forecast evolution, this is 15-17, and as I say, it's been very stable since the close of session. If we look at just general fund, we're just $8 million over what was expected at that time when the budget was crafted. So we're pretty close. This is a little higher than the $8 million because it also includes the lottery funds, and our unexpectedly strong lottery sales have added about $100 million to the biennium since the budget was drafted. So right now, 15-17 is looking stable. The next big hurdle is making it to December 31st without any big movements in the stock market or anything like that. And that will lock in some of this investment income for 2016, which is going to show up next April at the end of the biennium. And so hopefully if we can make it to December 31st without a whole lot of drama, we should be able to go through the current biennium without too much management necessary. As for next biennium, that's been pretty stable, too. This is the first forecast that actually matters for 17-19. This is the first forecast that feeds into the governor's recommended budget, which will come out here in a week or so, and it's kind of the kickoff to the budget drafting season. And this hasn't changed much either. We have been revising it down slightly over the last few rounds along with the economic outlook, but we're about $200 million lower, or 1% of the budget lower than our high water mark of about this time last year when we were the most optimistic about the outlook. But this one as well hasn't changed too drastically. Here, we don't get the boost from the lottery funds either. Although we do expect more because the sales have outperformed, that's offset here insofar as we had to incorporate in the last couple rounds the opening of the new Cowlitz Casino. So those offset them in these future biennia, whereas in the current biennia, we've seen an increase in our expected lottery revenues. Quick little topic I wanted to touch on because it's going to get some interest from what I understand in the upcoming legislative session is the small business tax cut that just came into play in 2015. And one of the facets of this tax cut is that if it comes in significantly higher than the LRO's original estimates, well, then this gets phased out to a certain extent, or it gets lessened. And I just wanted to come out and say this because typically we're in a situation where LRO's errors, and we have a couple to show you later, mess with our forecast. This one looks like maybe our problems might be messing with their forecast.
Sure. And so, maybe it's about time I put him under oath if he's going to start beating up LRO.
So in this case, as you see here, the dark lines are the current forecast for two different things. One would be Schedule E income, which includes S corporations and partnerships and trusts and LLCs and the like, the sort of things we might expect people to shift into because these are some of the, including these tax advantaged categories for the small business tax cut. Proprietors income, sole proprietors don't get this tax benefit. And so there was an expectation that when this tax cut went in, there would be some behavioral changes, some changes in organization, sometimes very simple to change from a sole proprietorship or something, or to add an employee in order to qualify. And so looking originally when we went from the September forecast that didn't have this cut in it to the December forecast, working off of LRO's estimates, we added about a couple billion dollars in terms of Schedule E income, half of that coming out of these shifts from proprietor's income into Schedule E. But unfortunately, before any of this could have happened, even in 2014, before the tax cut was even in law, we saw, as you see here, really sharp increases in both Schedule E income and proprietor's income. So in 2014, we were already at $7.5 billion in Schedule E, and up over $3.5 billion or so in proprietor's income, both of which higher than around where we expected to be, in 2020 down the road. And so unfortunately, the outlook is uncertain, but what this does is it's created a jump off. Now, to date, what we saw in terms of the first year, 2015, the outlook for this small business tax cut was very much in line with LRO's original estimate. In a couple years, I'm afraid it might not be, largely because it looks like the base is bigger than we than we expected, and these liability numbers were fed into their original estimates. So we'll see how this goes and whether or not there is a significant behavioral shift going forward.
Excuse me, Mark.
Yes.
Senator Boquist.
You've gone through a couple slides here, and I hate to be the, I guess Senator Beyer calls me Senator Sunshine. So you've painted this sort of picture of, you know, happy days are sort of here again, and there's no bottom out there. Your previous couple of slides outlined that corporate incomes are down and steadily down. And your forecast shows them, you know, frankly, either being flat or down, out, at least for those of us who are here for the next 4 years. This slide shows that small business is up. So that begs the question back to the good vice chair from the House committee, who raised the question of where are the jobs? This appears to me to show that the job creation is happening in small business in Oregon successfully, and corporate entities not so much. And I also look at the observation that generally when people are selling stock, it's because they anticipate things aren't going to be so great. So is this reflection here of small businesses doing better a reflection of they are probably the job generators?
Yeah, Senator Boquist, Senator Haas. To a certain extent, small businesses are generating more jobs than ever before. Over the last expansion, some estimates had it up to almost 50%. Now, they came from the Small Business Association, so maybe they like the numbers a little bit better, but that's significantly more than in past economic expansions, where we get half of our jobs from small business. So they are playing a bigger role than ever. Now, we do have to divorce income and profits from employment. And that's why these two different graphs may seem, you know, at the surface, a little contradictory. When we're looking at corporate taxes, we're looking at profitability, and we're looking at C-Corps and the big businesses and the like. And part of the reason we've seen this big hit in profitability is we saw that both the energy costs and more importantly, the terms of trade with the dollar becoming much stronger, and so this ate away at these profit margins. As that's stabilizing, we expect hopefully that the corporate taxes stabilize as well. But what's also going on here is erosion over time in terms of the effectiveness of corporate taxes. There are corporations' ability to organize around taxes, plus also the increasing trend to shift away from this traditional corporate structure and into different S-Corps, LLCs, and the like, which show up in personal income taxes, which is what we're talking about here, which is a different story. And instead of talking about profits here, we're talking about income generated, which is closely related, but not exactly the same case. And so these both looking at numbers and incomes in terms of the revenue don't always tie together with the job market. A biggest example of a deviation would be manufacturing, where all the growth is due to productivity and more technology, so we get a lot more output for the same number of workers. But that output shows up in terms of revenue and the like, but not necessarily jobs.
Generally, in a divorce, somebody makes money too, and then when that money is made, it's spent. So I guess you'd have to agree that despite your downplaying the jobs aspect here, when that money is spent or invested, it does itself create jobs too. Is that not correct?
Oh, certainly, Senator Boquist. I didn't mean to downgrade the income. And this is actually really exciting because this is one of the places, in particular the proprietor's income, where Oregon just looks really bad relative to other states. The concern about, you know, our per capita personal income, a lot of it comes from this, and a lot of it is technical because the way the Bureau of Economic Analysis calculates the proprietor's income is taking off of these tax returns, and Oregon has traditionally had less incentive for people to report income in this way than other states. And so it's encouraging to me to see this increase, but what it's going to do is may artificially make the LRO impact estimates of the small business tax cut too small.
Thank you.
Yeah. So one positive in the reason, or at least positive in terms of revenue gains, are estate taxes. And I've been running around saying we had the biggest month ever, that it was three or four times as big as ever. It looks here that it's more like two, so I've been exaggerating if you've heard me before. But this was a big one. And so this was a positive, and it largely offset the negative in this biennium from a weaker employment outlook that we showed because of the tracking and because of the manufacturing cuts that we went ahead and implemented. And so this extra $40 million that dropped in our lap was useful, but as you see, it obviously can't be expected in the future. This is one that we've just done a terrible job of forecasting over my tenure, the estate tax, and I'm really uncertain about it going forward. You know, on one hand, we have a big aging population who are ready to, you know, with a lot of assets, and a lot of the real estate assets have appreciated quite a bit. So there's a potential pool here of quite a bit of estate taxes of estates that are multi-million dollars in terms of real estate, at least, if not even considering others. But at the same time, there's a tax planning aspect, and accountants are pretty much universal in saying that they don't worry too much about the Oregon estate tax because they can kind of manage around it. They can set up family trusts and the like, and we can get away from having a big hit at the end of the day due to this. And so it's really hard for us to see, and looking at this over time, it's hard to say there's a much of an upward trend, and we try to model it, and it's been very challenging for us to fit it in. We'll never be able to model these huge spikes like we saw this month, but nevertheless.
Did you say this was from two estates or one? Did you say that spike was from just one estate?
That one month, we do not know if it's just one estate. We could look into it, but we didn't. But oftentimes, one estate shows up in several months or with several different taxpayers. You know, it will be responsible. But it's very likely that it is one large estate. It is very likely. But no, so this is a concern, and we don't know going forward. We have some growth in this going forward, but it could well exceed that or underperform it equally likely, I think, going forward. And this is a significant chunk over the, as you see here, over the biennium. So we also get quite a bit out of our excise taxes and our sin taxes, and given that it's not a sure thing that we'll get broad-based revenue reform, although I appreciate the efforts of everyone on these in this committee who are working very hard on that. But in absence of that, people are starting to talk about rounding up the usual suspects, and can we, you know, try to pull it together enough revenue to get us through at least this biennium whole. And some of the usual suspects are certainly these. We won't call them sin taxes, but excise taxes.
Sure. And so I'd like to go back a slide just to show off the great graphics work I've been doing. recently, I gave a presentation to county and city finance officers, budget folks, and this is something our office does, a lot of these vice revenues that don't get a lot of attention, at least, you know, outside of this out of this room, but they asked me to go through because we share a lot of this, right? There's a lot of revenue sharing between the cities and the counties and the states when it comes to vice revenues, and so we put together this graphic, and we've gone over some of these things with you, but again, in advance of the upcoming session, wanted to walk you through some of our thoughts on some of these revenue sources in our thoughts on the outlook, whether or not you know, adjustments are made moving forward or not. That is obviously outside the purview of our office, and any revenue impacts associated with that would come from.
Hey, Josh.
Yes, sir.
In my other job, I'm in that business. I wouldn't quit my day job if I
were. Agreed.
Sorry.
And so the first one is cigarettes. And we've talked with you before, brought this graph to you before. You see this long run downward trend in cigarette consumption here in the Northwest, and you see it across the nation. We've seen a decrease in the smoking rates from 25 to 30%, you know, a generation ago, down to right now Oregon's about 17% smoking rate, Washington's down to 15% smoking rate, something like that. And so we've seen a decrease in the number of smokers, but also the intensity of smoking, how much the typical smoker actually does. Again, 20 years ago, the average smoker smoked a pack a day, 20 cigarettes a day. Today, the average smoker smokes 14 cigarettes a day. So that's a reduction of, you know, nearly a third. So we've seen fewer people, and they're smoking a fewer number of cigarettes overall. And so you see this long-run trend. The other impact you see here in the Northwest is the impact of the border and different taxing jurisdictions. And that's what the red line is designed to show you. It's the Washington tax per pack of cigarettes minus the Oregon tax per pack of cigarettes. And so as the red line goes up, that means Washington raised their tax rate. As the line goes down, that means Oregon raised their tax rate and Washington didn't. Right now, we're basically at a historic record level difference between the state of Washington and the state of Oregon. They're up around a little over $3 a pack. We're around $1.30 a pack in terms of our taxes. And you can see the reduction in recent years was I believe that came out of the grand bargain, the 13 cents a pack increase. A lot of that was dedicated to mental health spending. But moving forward, we're looking at somewhere in the decline of 3% decline in tobacco consumption or cigarette consumption in the baseline outlook. That's in a stable tax environment. Of course, if taxes were to increase, we would see stronger declines in the consumption. But generally, tobacco taxes and cigarettes are inelastic. So if it's somewhere in the neighborhood of if you increase prices 10%, consumption would decrease 2 to 4%. The literature says 4%, but if you look at the recent years, it's more like 2%. So somewhere in that range, so even though you would see decreases in consumption, you would see a positive revenue impact. On the other tobacco product side of things, it's a couple different competing trends. Cigars are flat, relatively unchanged historically. Consumption of that seems to be not driven by broader smoking patterns or demographics or things like that. It just seems to be a pretty stable baseline of consumption for cigars. And then the moist snuff, that has generally been increasing in recent years. You can see here there's a downtick in the most recent data point. Our assumption right now is that's a blip. It's just maybe one wholesaler forgot to file their return that quarter, or maybe there's something else going on. We're not sure. But if you talk to all of our counterparts across the country, nobody's quite sure what to do with this, because this runs counter to a lot of the other tobacco and a lot of the other usage trends that you're seeing. But everyone kind of says 2 to 5% increase per year moving forward, and so we have 2.5 to 3% built into our outlook. I think it's somewhere just under 3% is our trend growth rate for other tobacco products moving forward. One idea here would be working on harmonizing taxes. If you raise cigarette prices, also increasing other tobacco products as to not create some sort of distortion in the marketplace where all you're doing is shifting consumption from one product to the other. But again, that's just something, substitution effects when it comes to tobacco products.
Excuse me, Senator Boquist.
Could you go back one slide? You won't know the answer to this question, I don't think, but if you could get back to me, I'd appreciate it. If you compared the cost per pack in taxation, our taxation rate for cigarettes, and you compared that to marijuana, I'd be curious to know, what is the equilibrium? I mean, are they comparable in tax rates, or is marijuana less, the taxation on marijuana less or more, so on and so forth? I'm sure you don't have a relative answer to that, but I'm just curious if we're at, what was it, something in there at $3 a pack up there in Washington? I'm just wondering, comparable to smoking cigarettes versus smoking joints or whatever they're calling them these days, what that comparable tax rate is. Are they really fairly equal, or is one higher or lower than the other? Thank you.
Senator Boquist, Chair Haas, we will get back to you on that. In terms of overall usage, not necessarily smoking marijuana. If you look at the DHS surveys of the Oregon population in terms of marijuana usage prior to legalization, I think 2014 is the most recent survey they have available on that. I believe the share of adult Oregonians that use marijuana is higher than the those that smoke cigarettes. And that was just in usage, but in terms of the amount and whether it's smoking versus edibles and things like that, you know, that dynamic's a little different too.
Your counterpart gets what I'm going at here. I mean, if we're smoking more marijuana and we're making a ton of more money or not on cigarettes, the question is, what's the tax equilibrium if they were the same? Yeah.
Which is interesting. Now, in terms of rates, I think the maximum on the marijuana is 25% now with the local option, if I'm correct. And so these would probably be higher than that 25% share if we're, you know, in terms of the rate of taxation. We do have a marijuana chart I'm going to skip ahead to, and then we'll go back and do lottery. Because just to mention that this is a pretty impressive growth rate, and it looks like it certainly is a growth industry. The original LRO estimate is probably good. We don't do the forecast for this. It's not general fund. It's all dedicated, so this isn't really under our umbrella, but it is. The numbers are getting bigger. It looks like the original impact estimate is probably going to be doubled at least, you know, in terms of what we're seeing coming in. It's difficult right now for the Department of Revenue folks to fully get a handle on it. While our folks in the industry are really good apparently about paying their taxes, they're willing to bring a bag of money over to Salem, but they're less good at filling out paperwork apparently, and so we're waiting a while on some of the data that underlies the revenues that we're getting in. But they're big, and the one thing that this is the graph that gets me the most in terms of the growth industry is looking at Washington, Southwest Washington, relative to the state as a whole. And what happened immediately after Oregon went ahead and legalized, we had a border impact. They lost more than a third of their sales in Southwest Washington. But since then, in the year since then, they've made them all up and are back on track with, you know, growing along the lines of everywhere else in the state. So to date, it looks like the consumption isn't really saturated, and that's that, you know. So there could be a, you know, some growth left in the future. You know, part of the concern was that we were going to get a lot of novelty sales and stuff, right, when it first, you know, became legal, and then these, you know, this would phase out over time as, you know, that was the novelty wore away. This would suggest that we're not quite there yet.
And then lastly, just a quick update on some research regarding the casino that is going into La Center, Washington, from the Callis tribe, the Alani Resort. There's a typo on this. This comes from some great new research that the research team out at Lottery has done in recent months. We asked them to work on this because we know there's a lot of cross-border activities, people just driving across the bridges in Portland and gaming for the convenience sake, because it's close by and it's across all the bars and restaurants in a lot of the state. And what they did is they went in and looked at lottery players, jackpot winners. They looked at the actual winners that, you know, you have to fill out your contact information if you win a prize over a certain threshold. By retailer establishment, these are technically census tract data, what share of the winners came from the state of Washington? You know, did they have a Washington address where they said, mail my check to? And you can see here, basically, we see a big impact in North Portland. The Hayden Island census tract, 82% of video lottery players in Hayden Island are Washingtonians. You can see it also in North Portland and out in Park Rose by the airport are also really, really high. This we knew. This actually was a little bit of a downside or a little bit of a lower number overall than I'd expected. Outside of North Portland, it's only about 3.5% of players or winners in the Oregon or in the Portland metropolitan area are Washingtonians. So we've actually lowered our casino impact relative to what we had 3 months ago. We've raised the video lottery sales forecast or the transfer forecast somewhere in the magnitude of $6 million. So not a massive change, but we've had less in the casino impact because of this research that the that they're doing. We see a huge impact on the border, but elsewhere in the Portland metropolitan area, it doesn't seem that Washingtonians are as larger share of the player base as maybe we had originally assumed. The other place you see here with a large cross-border impact is up in St. Helens across from Kelso Longview. Now, there's a lot of cross-border activity going on up there across that bridge, again, because of our cigarette taxes are lower, our liquor taxes are lower now that they've privatized, and we do have the video lottery. So there's a lot of cross-border activity up in Columbia County, as well as you can see by the map at the same time.
So the upshot for this current biennium is available resources down by $14 million. This is a couple of big positives and negatives you see over there that kind of wash each other out. Positive factor, again, we saw encouraging and real healthy payments here at the in the fall as the extension filers put in their returns, and we saw the big month in estate taxes that are helping this biennium. On the negative side, we've ratcheted down the near-term job growth as discussed, and yet another LRO mistake here was the PDX photo radar estimate is also coming in less than expected. This was apparently folks slow down when they're worried about getting a ticket, and so they're not, which is doing its job apparently very well. That folks are, and there's a little bit of an issue in terms of rollout. They've rolled out one station, but this is coming in about, I think we reduced about $15 million for the current biennium for this, in terms of a reduced estimate on the amount of money taken in from that. So, at any rate, so for the current biennium, there's really very little change. Added to this is just another million or two in terms of additional lottery. So as you see here, as we go the out years, not a whole lot of difference. 1921, we actually had a little bit faster employment growth in the current forecast, and we also added some investment income, which softened the blow then. But in the typical biennium here, we're losing somewhere between $25 and $50 million in the outlook. But that still represents growth, and not what we've become used to in the past, but still we're looking at somewhere around 10% in terms of the typical biennium in an expansion. And that's remained pretty stable over the last few forecast rounds. And finally, as I always add with, is reserves. We've almost hit the magic $1 billion mark. Not that that's magic in any way, and it's still not that big of a chunk of our general fund. You know, typically one standard deviation is, you know, 6 or 7%, somewhere in that range. We're not there yet, but this is a lot more than Oregon has ever had before. And some of this also is ending balance, which is a legislative decision. But nevertheless, this is a cushion that will help in the event of the eventual downturn. Not enough to fully heal the revenue side, but get us about halfway there probably in a typical recession. So with that, that's all of our prepared comments. But if there are any more questions, we'd be happy to take them.
Thank you for your presentation. Are there any questions? Representative Helm.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Given that we have a new administration and a new Congress federally, there's been some talk about reducing taxes at that level. Could you give us some broad brush strokes about what that might mean for the state, both from the income side and the revenue side?
Yes, Representative Helm. Senator Haas, again, a lot of these policies, I'm not sure exactly which ones are going to go through, and there are a whole lot of them out there in terms of potential tax cuts. Now, these are going to affect the state in a couple of ways. Typically, since we piggyback on a lot of the federal tax code, we do have to reconnect, and so there would be that issue sometimes. But for the most part, it would flow through, and it would be, in most cases, tax cuts do create near-term stimulus and do create economic output in the very near term. The concern is the trade-off in the longer term, because the fiscal stimulus has to be paid for at some point. And that's where we are, the only place we're actually seeing, you know, our whole wait-and-see process in terms of the presidential election. There is one place where it may tangibly affect the state budget immediately, and that would be in borrowing costs. Our state, we're going to go out here at the beginning of the year and borrow about $1 billion, and we've already seen rates increase significantly since the presidential election in response to higher perceived likelihood that the U.S. won't pay its debts.
Wow. Further questions? You got off easy today.
Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you. We will dismiss you until next time. We'll change chairs here. We'll take a 5-minute break and come back for a short presentation from the tax assessors.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bring the assessors up. Paul, could you kind of give us a headline?
I did want to tell the committee on a personal note that I've got my property tax bill, and for my West Salem home in Polk County that Doug Schmidt assessed. And I now am finally back above, my market value is now back above my Measure 50 value. So for the first time in 4 years. So I think that's a true sign of economic recovery in Polk County.
Being from Polk County, I just want to make sure, did you pay your bill by 5 o'clock yesterday?
Yes. And I got my 3% discount.
And I appreciate that. Thank you.
But we have asked our, and we've kind of made a tradition of this for the this forecast meeting to follow up the update on the general fund forecast with an early report from the assessors who have sent out the property tax bill. So they've got their preliminary data on what market trends are in their counties. So we've asked Bob Vroman from Clackamas County and Doug Schmidt from Polk County and Scott Langdon from Deschutes County to tell you about what's going on in those counties in terms of trends of assessed value and market value. Yeah.
Chair Haas, members of the committee. My name is Douglas Schmidt. I'm the assessor in Polk County, and thank you for letting me come and talk to you about Polk County today. We do have some slides, but first of all, I just wanted to let you know that for 2016, total real market value increased by 7% in Polk County, and total assessed value increased by a little over 5% in Polk County. The total residential property, which is bare land and improved, increased, the real market value increased about 9.6% this last year, and with a high of some areas of 123%. And just as a side note, those areas that went up the most were what we would consider the more affordable, lower-end homes. It could be manufactured home parks. The smaller homes in the county went up significantly. The total assessed value increased by 4.8%. The income property, which was apartments, commercial, and industrial, total real market value increased by 7.8% and assessed value by 5.7%. So the residential market increased greater than the business income property. In the last 3 years, in Polk County, the average single-family home value has increased 22%, while the average assessed value on that home increased 12%. And again, these percentages take into account any exception events, any new construction, things like that. So if that's more than 3%, which is what the law allows, but it takes into account those other increases above and beyond the 3%. There have been 403 new single-family units built in the last 3 years for an increase of 2.3 in the total units. The number of manufactured homes have decreased by 26, or 1.4%. Available single-family building lots have decreased by 239 lots for a decrease of 14% in the total units of available lots. Apartment living units have increased by 454. And the number of homes paying taxes based on their real market value has decreased from 25% to 4%. And that's a function of the market value going up and the assessed value limited to the 3% growth. That gap has almost eliminated, that number of properties paying on their market value is almost gone in Polk County. We're seeing that subdivision developers are not putting in large subdivisions in Polk County. They may own the land, but they're only developing 15, 20 lots at a time. And once those get partly built up, then they'll submit another plat. So we're not seeing the large subdivisions that we saw prior to the recession. It's smaller lots, and they go very quickly. New home construction is selling at a premium, partly because there's not a lot of shovel-ready lots available. There is increased material costs and a reduction in skilled labor. And I've seen this in articles coming out of Portland, kind of the same issue as to the reason why housing prices are increasing a little bit. We've seen a significant number of homes sell for cash, which is surprising. And it's typically in the upper-end homes, with the more median to lower-end homes still being financed. The rental market in Polk County and in the Valley is at a very low vacancy rate, and the rents have increased on the rental units too, whether it's a home or an apartment. And I had talked to some realtors, and they had an interesting take on this. Part of it was is that their homes were selling so fast that they hadn't had time to make an offer on another home, and therefore they were renting for a while. And then one that I hadn't even thought of, but the millennials are less likely to buy a home than they are to rent something because they want the ability to move. And so the rental market is really tight right now. So it's driving up the price of the rental property. So if we go to the first graph. Okay. This just shows the countywide change in value. This is all property as compared to the assessed value. So you see the dip. But then when we go to the residential property, there's a significant closing of that gap that's caused a lot of the properties to be paying on their real market value. It says at the bottom, the decline in real market value is 24% since its high in 2008 to its low in 2013. And then it has come back up to almost slightly under where it was in 2008. So the housing market is back almost to where it was prior to the recession. In the next set of slides or graphs, shows the comparison of the market, the recession on income property versus residential property. Yeah. Didn't have a lot of impact. It did go down because the value is a lot less on the income property. It doesn't show the blip, but it did go down about 12% from its peak and then come back up, where residential decreased 24%. And then the total compression loss due to revenue loss due to due to compression, measure 5, has dropped off substantially from its peak in 13 of $972,000 loss to now it's $417,000. And that's 0.48% of the total tax loss in the county. The in Polk County, we have a fairly low government rate, and so almost all of our compression losses in schools, 99.75% plus or minus, is schools. There's just a few hundred or a few thousand dollars of compression loss in government. So almost exclusively in education. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Okay. Good, any
scenario?
No, part?
That's a good snapshot of Polk County.
Okay, thank you.
Good morning, chairs, members of the committee. I'm Scott Langton, Deschutes County Assessor. We're seeing very similar things. I'm not going to go through each chart, but Kyle, can you put up that first one with the – there it is. Deschutes County, of course, with the highs and the lows, pre-recession, recession, now coming back out, we have maybe more – volatility in the change in that chart. But what I kind of find fascinating on that is information that LRO had put out that, you know, your 10-year history on taxes is about a 4.5% increase You look at Deschutes County, even with the volatility, it's 4.6. And I think you'll find that throughout the state that it's been fairly consistent as that went through. Of course, with the recession ending and Deschutes County bouncing back out of it really quickly, we're not quite back to pre-recession levels, but we're getting close. So, of course, we're seeing compression on schools and general government going down each year. Vast majority of our properties are now back to having an assessed value based on that Measure 50 maximum assessed, where market value is kind of disconnected again. One thing, though, is pre-recession in the building boom, and we're in a building boom now, our permitted activity is only about 60% of what the permitted activity was pre-recession. So with that, the base is much higher now, but the number of permits aren't, so you're not seeing that huge assessed value increase. When you wait it out over time, it's real consistent with the rest of the state, but we're, as the base grows, permitted activity would have to grow equally or greater to maintain that, you know, 6-7% AV increase. So we're back into kind of what the rest of the state right now, it appears, where it would be that 4.5-5%. So I won't go through the rest of the graphs. You guys can look at that, and if you have questions. One thing I would like to note, though, is, you know, what we're hearing out among our constituents. We do town halls in Deschutes, and we also have, you know, a lot of calls, walk-ins. In the last 4 weeks, we get about 3,000 inquiries, personal contacts, which 100,000 accounts, that's about 3%. So whether they're representative of the population of a whole or they're a subset, I would love to be able to figure that out. I don't know. But basically, you know, the three big things I hear is, one is the inequities, Measure 50, and similar houses paying different taxes. Another one would be seniors and the lack of programs for those on fixed incomes. And that was a huge outcry this year in town halls that a number of people were looking to, how do we fix that? What programs could be available or should there be? And then the other one is the 3%. I find it interesting that the assessors are in a unique spot where between the taxpayer, our customer, and the taxing district, our other customer, that you hear taxing districts talk about 3% isn't enough to maintain service. But now we've been into Measure 50, 20 years now, the 3% compounded plus new voter initiatives, and a lot of people saying that's not realistic when you compound that on the increase in taxes. So it's kind of fascinating to hear both sides and where the disconnect is between the voter and the property owner when they're paying taxes.
Mr. Chair,
excuse me. Rep. Barnhart.
Thank you. My recollection before 1990 was that taxing districts were allowed to increase their tax base assessment based on their budgets, the exact title of which I can't remember anymore, by 6% without a vote. That allowed for compounding, at least in some places, that was considerably higher than 3%, didn't it?
Yes, Mr. Chair, that's absolutely right. Pre-Measure 50, each district could go up 6% without voter approval. Most did that. Then you had a levy rate that would change each and every year based on that budget amount needed. Then those were applied to the market values of properties,
right.
So then people, it was the uncertainty of how their property performed compared to other properties where you could see big tax shifts year to year. There was that volatility where Measure 50 built in that that stability as far as at least more of the predictability of the 3% AV increase.
All right, let me follow up if I could. So we have more certainty now in the change. from year to year. But the change that was possible, at least in many places, depending upon changes in the base, the property base, and the tax rate, excuse me, the tax, the budget amount, could easily exceed that 3% compounding, couldn't it? In fact, often did before Measure 50.
Oh, yes, that is correct.
I guess, Mr. Chair, my comment on his presentation is that, if anything, the compounding as it exists now is less than it used to be before Measure 50. Taxpayers, of course, are always going to complain about the fact that their taxes went up. That's normal human nature. You know, when my Comcast bill goes up, I complain about it.
Well, taxpayers can complain about that, about taxes being too high. They will always complain about that. But when you get to a situation where one taxpayer is paying a higher amount than the homeowner whose home is of the same value, then you have a real serious problem. And that is just getting worse and worse and worse, to the point where I think our property tax system is almost in a virtual state of collapse, unless we fix that part. Because when taxes start to become
arbitrary
and unfair, you have a serious public finance problem.
Right. Mr. Chair, that wasn't the comment I was making, but I completely agree with that one.
Yes, I
absolutely.
Understand.
Well, and just a follow-up on that. That's the reason I brought that up, is that, you know, we have contact with roughly 3% of our customer, the property taxpayer. Those were the three big concerns that I heard, and I just wanted to share those with you, not pointing judgment one way or another, but those are kind of the hot button issues during this tax season and prior ones that kind of hit the forefront.
Representative Benz, did you have a comment?
I did. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just curious. The leaf charts don't go back as far as Co-Chair Barnhart's remarks back to the 90s. It would be great to see those, and I'm sure they're available, but if you have them readily available, it would be great to see them. One of the things that I was going to comment on but didn't in the just previous presentation from the assessors was the driving up, shall we say, by our own design of the cost of housing and thus the values by virtue of our land use planning system. And it would be interesting to see how much higher those values are as a result of what we have done in part, against which these either the assessed value or the market value operates, the percentages that you were talking about, Chair Barnhart. But if I could see those numbers, how much growth there's been in the overall value of our housing base over the last 40 years, so we can get to the heart of the discussion about this Measure 5 thing. And I want to join Chair Haas in agreeing that the system is incredibly complex and needs attention.
We all agree.
Yeah, we all agree.
Well, I know for myself it takes an hour to hit the high level of how our system works when I do a town hall, and to me I find that a little concerning that we have that complex of a system. It takes that much time.
Okay, thank you.
Chair Haas, Chair Barnhart, my name is Bob Roman. I'm the Clackamas County Assessor, and thank you for giving me an opportunity to come before you today and tell you a little bit about my county, Clackamas County. We're one of the three counties, three Oregon counties that makes up the Portland metropolitan area. So I'm sure it'll be no surprise to you that we've had an extraordinarily strong real estate market. And that puts pressures on that market, certainly as far as affordability and how that market actually behaves. Total value, real market value for all property in Clackamas County grew 12.7% last year. We had increases in real market value that actually, really started to to approach the pre-recessionary years. Because I had property areas that were growing anywhere in a range from about 6 to 24% in Milwaukee. So huge real market value growth. With Oregon's property tax system, though, generally most of our properties were growing assessed value-wise in that range of about 3%. We have very few properties any longer that are being taxed at their real market value. Real property accounts, we total about 165,000, and we maybe have about a little bit less than 2,000 now where real market value will actually be the assessed value of the property. So if we could go to my first table, and I'm not going to go through everything, but I do want to point out just a couple of highlights. And that is, if you look at the graphic representation, you'll see that real market value does have those troughs and valleys that we would expect that follow what's happened with our real estate market. And this goes back to just the pre-recessionary years to current. But if you looked at the green line, which is green on the screen, thankfully, it shows you that predictability and stability that at least this system did bring as far as assessed value growth. A couple things that are important to understand is that assessed value grows two ways. It grows that statutory 3%, and then it grows as a result of new construction. And so if we can take a look at the next table, it's something that you may not have seen as often. And that is what I provided for you was a representation of what our exception value actually looked like from 2006 through 2016. Now, what I mean by exception value is that portion that contributes to assessed value that's a result of new construction, remodeling, subdividing, maybe rezoning where that property is being used consistently with the new zoning, and those types of things that allow a property's assessed value to grow in excess of that statutory 3%. What's a little bit remarkable here is that if you look back in 2006, 2007, when our market was really strong, and in 2007 really was the high point of our real estate market in our area, you'll see that our exception value or new growth, new construction is significantly higher, almost $2.2 million compared to what we had this year, which is about $1.4 million. The translation of that exception value or new value into assessed value is represented by that green line, and you would think that it might follow very closely, but you can see in the early years, in 2006, 2007, the gap between what that real market value produced in taxable assessed value growth is much greater, and that's a result of our changed property ratio activity, which is that provision in Measure 50 that gives new construction a similar benefit that other properties are receiving from Oregon's property tax system, because new construction doesn't go on the roll at 100% of its real market value. Really sort of remarkable is that back in 2007, what this is telling you is that we were actually calculating taxes on about 50% of the real market value of new construction. In 2016, we're calculating taxes, at least for our residential properties in Clackamas County, at about 71%. Of its real market value. And what that tells you is that our markets aren't quite back to where they were pre-recessionary times. I'm not going to go back to the first slide, But if you get a chance and look at the first slide, you'll see that in 2008, our total real market value in Clackamas County was almost $60 billion. We just exceeded that $60 billion for the first time since that recessionary period this year by about $3.5 billion. So our total value has grown to greater than what we were the pre-recessionary period. But we're really not quite back there yet in the form of total activity. I think that that's one of the more remarkable things. If you can go to the next slide, please, Kyle. This is just, again, a representation of our number of accounts where the taxable value is actually the real market value. And the red line on the bottom is our real property accounts. And so out in 2016, we have very few that are still being taxed at their real market value. Some of those are going to be sort of systemic, which would be our major manufacturing type properties where they're generally our machinery and equipment, where generally they're going to continue to be taxed at their real market value because they're often a depreciating asset. But the purple line on top is our business personal property. It's all being taxed at its real market value because, again, it's a depreciating asset typically. And our manufactured structures, while their real market values are growing because they're a very affordable type of housing, comparatively speaking to conventional, we're still at about 85% of those properties are being taxed at their real market value. And then public utilities, that's the blue line. I'll just call that to your attention. That's the portion of the value in our role that's actually done by the Department of Revenue. And as you can see, for district purposes and for our purposes, it's a very difficult type of value to predict because it's a lot more volatile than what we've seen. So we certainly have a lot more of those public utility properties this year, primarily probably because of our communications companies where they're being taxed at their real market value this year as opposed to a maximum assessed value. Our compression history, which is on the next slide, will be very similar to what you've heard from both Scott and Doug in their counties, and that is because our real market value is growing at a faster rate, significantly greater than the assessed value grows, we're seeing less and less compression. When you have less compression, that means less savings that a property owner might be receiving, but a few more dollars that taxing districts are actually realizing. Our total compression for Clackamas County, and this is dollars that we would not be collecting, dropped from $10.3 million last year to about $7.9 million this year. And most of that loss, as you can see, is still in the education category. Finally, just tax imposed is my last slide. Our total taxes that we impose to all property owners in Clackamas County on all properties grew at about 5%. Taxes typically grow at a slightly different rate than assessed value grows. There's always that idea that out there in the general public, a lot of times, the taxes can only go up 3%. So when I talk about this, and that's generally true for an individual property, but we add new construction, and taxes can grow a couple of additional ways. And that is we have people that pass new money measures or update local options. And so that can contribute to the total growth of tax in any jurisdiction. There's also a fourth way that we've had a lot of fun dealing with over the last few years as our real market value has grown a lot more than our assessed value, and that is as we have less compression, those property owners, you know, see a slightly less tax because there's tax that we don't collect, and now we're collecting a little more of that tax, so that contributes to that growth in our total tax roll. So there are a lot of interesting things that you get when you kind of start to compare these charts. But we've been in a very interesting real estate market, and just one sort of parting comment is that I looked at the October RMLS figures. This is our real estate multiple listing service sale price information for October, and from October to October, the Portland metropolitan area generally was up about 11% already. So real market values continue to grow.
You said the Measure 50 limits had a stabilizing stability component to it, which is good. But it sounds that's kind of an argument against proposals we've had up here to repeal the Measure 50 limits in order to get at this equity thing. Is that I hear that? Is that your kind of position?
Chair Haas, not exactly. If that's what it sounded like, it wasn't necessarily what I meant. Measure 50 has more of that leveling effect, and I think it was commented by Scott that really when Measure 50 passed, it was more of a trade-off of uniformity and equity being on a real market value system to predictability and stability that was brought on by taking you off a real market value system and then generally calculating taxed on permanent rates times a limited growth on assessed value.
I agree with that. So if we keep those limits and keep it in place, how do we fix this equity thing that where the properties are calibrated back to 1997 and now they're all out of sync and people with similar price homes are paying vastly different property tax bills?
Chair Haas, that's probably
that's a small little question.
Well, I could bottle that one up. I could maybe sell it. That's the biggest, probably the most challenging question that we have before us as far as the property tax system. And that would be that it's not really the Measure 5 limits, again, because that could be something potentially if someone wanted to keep those limits that could be a factor that might be able to be used to adjust the amount of revenue that could be collected or would not be collected. The challenge will be to bring that assessed value in areas where there's been a great discrepancy between the gap between real market value and assessed value back to a more equitable level, because just to give you an example, Multnomah County probably provides the best example of really huge differences in properties that have the same real market value but are paying dramatically different taxes based on a dramatically different maximum assessed value. In Clackamas County, and in many ways, we're a county that enjoyed to some extent very uniform growth in a lot of our areas. I mean, we have some where we have that type of discrepancy, but both our increases in real market value and our decreases in real market value probably were a little more uniform, so we may not have as many of the vast discrepancies, but this is something that's systemic and goes back to the introduction of this system.
And if I might just shirt-tail on to that, I agree with what Bob said, that we don't have the current system because people were happy with the old system. That had its problems. Now we've been in this system for 20 years. Were the concerns that were 20 years ago still those same concerns today? Were the consequences now 20 years later anticipated and acceptable or not? I kind of doubt it. That's where, I think that I can speak for myself and my fellow assessors, we are more than willing to work with whomever on modeling whatever change it is to try to minimize, you know, so people know those impacts on whatever that happens to be. And it is going to be a trick as far as how do you have stability and predictability and equability at the same time. I think we can get there. It's just, what is it that the model that'll work?
I feel, I don't know why I always feel the duty to mention this when we get into this discussion, but the godfather of Oregon's property tax revolt, Don McIntyre, before he passed away, came to this committee and said, you need to get rid of the Measure 50 limits or else you'll have this inequity problem, and just go back to the Measure 5 limits, adjust them downward if you need to, but so that came from him. He sort of predicted this. It is happening. It is a mess. And, of course, anything we do, we have to go to the people for a constitutional vote, and trying to get voters to understand this thing that would take you an hour to explain to them is really a huge challenge. Did you have a question?
I just had a brief question, Mr. Chair. The slide that was not overly mentioned by Deschutes County, the inverse is you're at a negative compression rate. Is that not correct? You're at a $1.5 million negative compression rate. So, well, compression is impacting Doug there to my right at $400,000 and impacting Clackamas County at 7 point whatever.
Nine.
You're actually at a negative. Is that not correct?
Vice Chair, it's the same scenario. I just drew my graph backwards. Those negatives are the amount of dollars lost. So when you look at that, we had $1.5 million not collected.
The three of you didn't compare notes and get your
slides. We didn't.
All right. Hopefully, if we have to revalue houses and do 50, you guys will get coordinated. Okay. No wonder it's confusing.
Rep. Smith Warner, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just be interested. There is some consistency clearly among your counties of how the rates have gone and all that. I would actually be interested in finding out, particularly from my colleague, Representative Bence's district, perhaps Baker, one of those eastern counties, and also Josephine, some other counties that we've heard. I would be interested to see if their experiences dovetail with, basically, I'm looking for, are there outlier counties in these trends since 2007? And who are they, and you know, and what's happening there? So it's not really a question for you guys. It's really more of an LRO request for Kyle. Okay.
Chair Hass, members of the committee, I do not envy your looking at the property tax system, because as we have started to see the market values increase, you're seeing those disparities again, and to create a protection or a safety net for people on how their market value goes up, to do it on even a neighborhood-wide basis, let alone a statewide basis, that is going to be very, very difficult. And you asked if, you know, I don't know. I'm not sure how you would do that. But we, like Scott said, we would be happy to work with you and provide input and information.
I think we got to give voters at least an opportunity to put some equity back into this system and eliminate those disparities. I really do, and point them out, and maybe sweeten the package a little bit with a homestead exemption or something. But that's all we can do, and I think it's our duty to do that.
Chair Hass, members of the committee, I would just add, because Scott had mentioned it too, that I've been doing town halls around our county we've been doing them for over 20 years, and I go out to all my jurisdictions. What your comment just alluded to, I think, is something that we hear as well, and that is that within our current system, it certainly has created some affordability issues tax-wise for a lot of our people on limited incomes, and there aren't very many programs, whereas in a number of states they have programs for owner-occupied homes or different types of programs for senior citizens. That's probably the comment that I heard more than anything this last year, is that it would be really nice if Oregon had something of that type that might be available to citizens. So I very much agree with your comment.
Okay. We'll contact your legislator and let
some of mine are here today.
Any other comments, questions?
Then we will let Kyle top off this property tax discussion with some summations and perspectives.
This is a pretty interesting graph. This should be included every time.
Good morning, Mr. Chairs, members of both committees. Kyle Easton, Legislative Revenue Office. And yeah, what I have here today is it's just a one-page document. It's in the meeting materials on OLIS, and it's initial look at the imposed figures we have for the 16-17 property tax year. So the way the data sets up is it comes in from the assessors. They submit forms to the Department of Revenue. Department of Revenue does some work to get the data really in a workable format so that we can do the type of analysis that Representative Smith Warner, you were asking about. So unfortunately, I don't have answers to those questions today. We could look back a year and certainly do that sort of look at what's going on in different counties and different areas. But it's probably a few months out before we'll have the 16-17 data ready to get into that level of detail. But I did want to share at least at the high level statewide figures for the imposed. So this is just comes from some summary tables that we get. So the figures are still preliminary, but being at such a high level, I wouldn't expect them to really move much. But so just looking at the one-page document there, I start off with the overall property tax imposed and then give some the last 10 years to give some sense of where the trend is. So statewide, we're looking at growth was about 4.7%. So we went up from $6.1 billion imposed to 6.4. And the 4.7% is pretty close to that 10-year trend, which is 4.5, so a little above that. The trend since 97, 98, which is post measures 5 and 50 becoming fully phased in, you're seeing the average growth is 5.1%. So it's a little bit below the trend since 97, 98, but pretty much in line with where we've been for the last 10 years. However, each year can have some ups and downs. So in the column chart that's below there, I have the last 10 years, the growth rate beginning with 07, 08, going up to the 16, 17. And you can quickly see in the 11, 12, and 13 fiscal years, the post-recession periods, the housing bubble burst, growth in property taxes. We still had year-over-year growth, so never went negative or anything to that effect, but growth was about 1.8, 1.7, 1.6% in those years, so a little less than 2%. Beginning in 2013-14, we're seeing growth closer to that 5%, and we've been there for about the last 4 years. So the 16-17 figures are in line. They're a little bit down, but more or less in line with where we've been the last few years. In the next chart over, this is the property taxes imposed as a percent of personal income here in Oregon. And it's a chart we show just to give some indication. Property tax, of course, is linked to the value of the property, but it gives some sense, well, what's the stability to other sources? So personal income is a good comparison. And you can see it's fairly steady in the last 10 years. Again, this is property tax imposed as a percentage of personal income. So if income's changing, depending upon what property tax is doing, you could see that movement. So there's two factors that can cause a movement in this line. But one thing of note that I didn't go all the way back 30 years or so, but if you went back to pre-measures 5 and 50, you're going to see we're closer to about 5% of personal incomes where property taxes are. So there really was a level shift down following measure 5 and 50 coming in.
Representative Benz.
Right, you may have just answered the question, but this graph of percentage of personal income, have you taken it all the way back to 25 years ago then? So we can see what that percentage is today as compared. Were you just saying that and I wasn't listening?
Yes, Representative Benz, that's what I was saying. If we go back and I can show, I do have a chart for that, it's closer to 5%. So it's somewhat stable in the past years as well, and there's a little bit of movement, but as soon as you see measure 5, the timing of measure 5 and 50, you just have a trend down. And then we level off again here at about between around 3.5%, really. But, yeah, you have seen this level shift down, and then we've stayed there. So you have seen this drop in property taxes as a share of personal income. And I can definitely share that with the committee. I think that's one that we include in the briefing book at the beginning of the session as well, in the large one.
Thank you.
Okay. So that's the overall imposed. And then the next two charts I have are, one is sitting on that compression reduction. So the assessors mentioned this. So this would be this, for the statewide. And nothing really differs here than what you saw at the three assessor panels that were up here. But so in 15-16, we're at about $165 million in compression. So that's the reduction due to the Measure 5 limits. We're now down to about $145 million. And you can see the last 10-year trend, compression was about $50 million, a little above that. As these real market values were going down, you saw compression going up because you're more likely to hit those Measure 5 limits. Well, now we're in kind of the post-housing bubble burst period. Real market values are once again going up, and in a continuing sentence, we're seeing growth there. Compression is coming down, and that's pretty much what we would expect to see. So once again, we're a little bit below where we were the previous year. Now, again, this is to get to the kind of, I don't have the chart on it, but this is definitely, compression is a different factor in different areas throughout the state. So I think generally you're seeing compression, about half of that is in Multnomah County, I believe, or districts within the county, not just the county district. Now, part of that reflects just the fact that Multnomah County represents a lot of the property tax base, but there are different areas of the states where compression is a bigger issue, and certainly in different districts too. I mean, you'll hear from different cities that are more affected by compression than others, which have no effect. So this is really can be a localized issue and a district-by-district issue. But the overall trend is continuing decrease in compression loss. And then the other, the last chart I have there is the urban renewal imposed. And again, it looks pretty steady. There's not a whole lot. We've had a little bit of an uptick here on about a 9% growth, but we've seen it hovering about 200 to now, it would be the upper limit, about $240 million over the last 10 years. But it's usually a fairly steady amount there. So no real surprises. But like I said, again, it'd still be a couple months before we can really dive into more details, but hopefully we'll be able to have some of that at the start of the session in February.
Okay. Questions for Kyle?
All right. So if I could add just one thing, Mr. Chair, just kind of looking ahead. Our next step here is with these updated property tax numbers, and they will start to look at those in terms of the forecast for property tax revenue for schools for the school formula, and then we'll have an update for you on the projections for local revenue in the early in the session.
Okay, and Paul, in December, will you have the tax haven report?
Mr. Chair, the tax haven report statutorily is not due until, well, there's two of them actually. One coming from Department of Revenue, and we would expect that right about the 1st of February is when that's due. They're working on that now. We just met with them. You also, in Senate Bill 61, assigned us to do an analysis of the first year of data, which is coming in now, and that's due March 15, 17. Okay. So we're working on both those reports. So I would anticipate during the first week of the session, you'll have the full report from Department of Revenue. Well, they'll recommend any changes to that list of jurisdictions based on their analysis.
Okay, and where are we with the Schedule E grant?
The Schedule E, as you recall, that the state economist was mentioning that takes effect for the 15 tax year, and so we really don't feel like we had a good sense of that until we get a chance to look at those extended returns. Chris is looking at those now, and we would anticipate putting that on the agenda for December for both the Senate and the House committees. So Chris will go through, and we won't have a lot of data, but that'll be our first chance to look at real data on how close we were on the estimates. We did estimate about for 17-19 a loss of about $205 million from that provision. So we won't know how close we are on that, but at least we'll know whether we're close on the terms of the starting point, and we'll give you an updated estimate of what that looks like.
Thank you. Any other comments? Okay, then we will adjourn. The Senate Interim Committee on Finance and Revenue is adjourned.
And the House Interim Committee on Revenue is adjourned.